You are listening to another exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. Welcome to today's podcast. We thought this might be an excellent time for another episode of our Ask Dr. Blevins podcast series. So we set out to get some questions from you, our readers and listeners. And your responses did not disappoint, as we received many excellent questions. For this episode, we selected several questions we feel will be relevant and interesting to everyone. We plan to continue with this series as we believe your questions can help others as they deal with their own conditions in everyday life. We received hundreds of questions and truly wish we could respond to every one of them in a timely manner. So if your question was not selected this time, stay tuned as we may select it for a future podcast. So let's get started. By the way, I'm going to read the questions as we receive them, and Dr. Blevins will follow with the answer. Stephanie asks, I am 58. I was operated for a craniopharyngioma on August 2014. I suffer from panhypopituitarism. I take cortisol, Synthroid, testosterone cream, and DDAVP. I have been testing Ritalin in the past few weeks to improve my concentration at work. I was back at work April 2015. Before this tumor, I was a very active person, skiing, cycling, 8,000 miles a year, etc. No limits. I can't do this anymore. But I want to improve my physical endurance. If I train hard for 60 to 90 minutes, I am dead for 2 or 3 days. I know I will never come back like I was. But I want to get any improvement possible without affecting adversely my health or increasing the possibility for the tumor to come back. I am told to limit my activities. Should I accept my condition and limit my physical activity? What do you recommend?
Stephanie, first off, thank you for your question. It's a rather interesting one to me. And it sounds like you have a disorder of hypopituitarism where you take hormone replacement and yet you're not feeling well. And many of the symptoms that you talk about in your question, including the inability to concentrate, decreased physical exercise capacity, feeling dead, wondering why you're not improving in response to attempts to exercise, all of those things are classic symptoms and signs of growth hormone deficiency. You didn't mention that you take growth hormone, and I suspect that growth hormone deficiency is your problem. So my advice would be to first ensure that your current dose of Synthroid is adequate. Make sure that the amount of steroid that you're taking is appropriate, because it's shocking that even in today's day and age, some patients are taking very low doses of steroids. So you want to make sure those two hormones are just right. If they are, I would prompt your physician to test you for growth hormone deficiency, including a glucagon stimulation test or an arginine stimulation test. Certainly you need a baseline IGF-1 level. And if your craniopharyngioma is controlled and not progressing or not of a concern, you might consider growth hormone replacement. We've done a number of podcasts on growth hormone deficiency and replacement, so I encourage you to look at those to get even more information about this particular condition. But I do believe that you have classic presentation of growth hormone deficiency in a patient who has hypopituitarism and needs treatment. So good luck with that.
Okay, so here's the next question. Dr. Blevins, would you please further explain the dynamics between cortisol and growth hormone? Does raising growth hormone levels always lower cortisol or cortisol-binding globulin levels? Does it also work the other way? If you treated cortisol insufficiency but not GH, would it lower GH? In other words, does cortisol and growth hormone work against each other? Also, please explain cortisol-binding globulin and its functions in regards to cortisol. If GH injections lower cortisol-binding globulin, how does that translate to lower cortisol? Thank you very much for taking the time to answer questions.
This is a very good question, and obviously you're very informed about the relationships between growth hormone and cortisol, or you wouldn't have asked in the first place. Let me try to explain it. So we know that cortisol is metabolized by the liver and the kidney, and there are a number of enzymes, especially in the liver, that convert cortisol to cortisone and to tetrahydrocortisol and also tetrahydrocortisone. And these two organs, the liver and the kidney, metabolize cortisol based on the need to metabolize cortisol, for one thing, because cortisol changes the level of the expression of these enzymes. And we do know that growth hormone, if you're growth hormone deficient, you're going to metabolize cortisol much more slowly, because growth hormone affects these enzymes as well. So that if you have, let's say you have partial adrenal insufficiency or mild adrenal insufficiency, and you make enough cortisol to get by, if we started you on growth hormone, we will induce those enzymes to metabolize your cortisol faster, and we can actually precipitate adrenal insufficiency by the lowering of your cortisol levels because they're metabolized more quickly. And we do see that clinically, and there are some patients that I've seen who had what looked like relatively normal cortisol levels, but hypothyroidism and growth hormone deficiency and maybe gonadal deficiency, we start them on growth hormone, and rather feeling better, they feel poorly. And then we test and we find that their cortisol levels have fallen, they have an abnormal stimulation test, and we start them on steroid hormone replacement and they feel much better. So yeah, there is a real connection there. And that's important and needs to be considered clinically. The most relevance that I see is in patients who are already on steroid replacement. If they're taking hydrocortisone or cortisone acetate, starting growth hormone will accelerate the metabolism of those medications and may precipitate adrenal crisis, and you need to go up on the dose. But the best thing to do is to switch to dexamethasone. It's a more longer-acting steroid and is not affected by the induction of growth hormone causing those enzymes. So that's pretty much how I look at it. There's really not an association with cortisol binding globulin. However, keep in mind that estrogen supplementation can increase cortisol binding globulin levels, just as pregnancy can, or contraceptives, for example. But I'm not aware of growth hormone injection itself changing cortisol binding globulin, but it really affects the metabolism of cortisol. And this is an important consideration clinically in treating patients who have adrenal insufficiency or maybe partial adrenal reserve, who have growth hormone deficiency and need to go on treatment.
Great. That was really an excellent question. So here's another one. It says, hi, Dr. Blevins. Is it possible to have subtle acromegaly as well as Cushing's disease that is constantly elevated IGF-1 plus some classical clinical features of acromegaly but suppression following the OGTT? I also have persistent / residual Cushing's disease with clear evidence of tumor on MRI with unexplained high IGF-1. Thanks.
Well, yes. In fact, I've published a paper in a patient who actually presented with what we thought was acromegaly and ended up also having Cushing's. There was a large growth hormone secreting pituitary tumor and a small ACTH secreting pituitary tumor. And so the patient had both diseases. And when we started looking at the clinical picture, of course, both of them were present. We were just sort of impressed with the acromegaly and missed the findings of Cushing's, including osteonecrosis of the femurs and mild diabetes, which was thought to be due to the acromegaly, and hypertension thought to be due to the acromegaly, but was probably due to both disorders. What we call multiple pituitary adenomas or plurihormonal adenomas are seen in about 2% of patients with pituitary tumors, so it's very rare. The most common thing you'll see is a patient has a pituitary tumor, and then they get to surgery, and they're found to have an ACTH-producing pituitary tumor and a prolactinoma, or maybe also a Rathke's cleft cyst. But yes, there are several case reports of patients who've had acromegaly and Cushing's due to pituitary tumors. And it's also possible to have acromegaly and adrenal Cushing's due to adrenal nodular disease. So that has to be considered as well. I do believe that there are patients out there who have elevated IGF-1 levels that are normal for them. And we tend to rely on the oral glucose suppression test to sort of sort those out as to whether or not those patients truly have acromegaly. If they suppress with oral glucose, probably don't have acromegaly, but I have seen a couple of people who had elevated IGF-1 levels and partial suppression with oral glucose and had a tumor, so we operate, take the tumor out, stains for growth hormone. So that's a pretty clear-cut picture if that's the case. I think that what we usually see in Cushing's disease is suppression of IGF-1. So if you have persistent or residual Cushing's with a tumor on an MRI, usually I'd expect to see a low IGF-1 in that setting. So you might actually be one of these folks that does have a tumor secreting both hormones or two separate pituitary tumors. So that needs to be evaluated. And if you have residual tumor, you might need to see a neurosurgeon to deal with this and try to resolve this issue. Back to the IGF-1 issue, though, there are lots of different things that can affect IGF-1 levels, including nutritional status, uncontrolled diabetes, for example. And it could be, you know, by definition, 2.5% of people have an elevated IGF-1 level but are normal, so you might be one of those folks. But it certainly should be ferreted out, and if you have tumor on MRI, it should be evaluated in order to determine whether or not you have a problem with immunostaining due to growth hormone that would explain the biochemical picture of the elevated IGF-1 level.
Okay, excellent. Now, here's another question that affects people as they make that dreaded decision to go or not to go to the emergency room. The question from Sharon is, should one go immediately to the hospital as soon as one starts to vomit, regardless of what time of the day it is? Or is it okay to wait until nighttime dosing to see if the cortisol replacement will stay down? If one goes to the hospital and their BP is normal, does one need additional dosing of cortisol replacement?
Well, sure. If you take hydrocortisone or dexamethasone or some other steroid for central or primary adrenal insufficiency and you can't keep your medication down or you're not sure you have ingested and digested that medication, go to the emergency room. Don't take a chance. You need to get those steroids by vein. If you have an illness that's causing vomiting, you probably have an illness that requires IV steroids and even stress dose steroids, so don't hesitate. Go to the emergency room. Some physicians do prescribe injectable steroids for patients. But what I've found is that a lot of patients can't sort of manipulate that in the syringe and the vial to do that. So I think the easiest thing is go to the emergency room and present yourself for medical care. And don't wait. Don't say, maybe I'll be better by the morning. Just go. Even if they don't admit you, at least you go and you get steroids by vein. And sometimes that's all you need. So go to the hospital and get evaluated and see what happens. And they'll either keep you or not, but at least you'll get steroids and you'll get them by vein and you'll know they're in your system and you'll know that you can get through the next couple of days and or maybe at least the next day and survive and perhaps recover from whatever's causing the nausea and the vomiting.
Okay, so here's another question from the same listener. Can growth hormone deficiency or panhypopituitarism cause an increased risk for DVTs?
Well, this is a very interesting question. We do know that growth hormone deficiency leads to blood that is more atherogenic, in other words, more likely to cause coronary disease or cerebrovascular disease. I don't know that growth hormone deficiency actually increases the risk for blood clotting. Panhypopituitarism can, however, lead to a risk of cerebrovascular disease as well. And certainly in patients who take estrogen supplementation, if you take them orally, the first pass through the liver might change clotting factors and could increase your risk for deep vein thrombosis. So you need to be careful about that, especially if there's a family history of blood clots in the legs or pulmonary embolism, or if you have one of the known genetic mutations that can lead to blood clotting disorders. The other thing I'll say is that a Cushing's disease and hypercortisolism leads to an increased risk of deep vein thrombosis randomly and also especially after surgery for either pituitary surgery or adrenal surgery. So you need to be aware of that as well.
Okay, here's another interesting question. Is it possible to have high cortisol levels that are not caused by anything and it's just normal for certain people? The reason I ask is because I had an adenoma on the left lobe of my pituitary gland removed. In fact, I had 95% of the gland removed, as pathology showed diffused hyperplasia and an overabundance of ACTH cells throughout the whole gland. My cortisol levels pre-surgery were 12 times normal. Post-surgery, they are still 9 times normal. I have been told that's normal for me. Would love to hear what you think.
Well, that's fascinating that you were found to have diffuse hyperplasia and overabundance of ACTH cells. This is a very rare cause of hypercortisolism in Cushing's, and it could be that you have a tumor somewhere secreting corticotropin-releasing hormone, or CRH. That might be a neuroendocrine tumor in the lung or somewhere else, or you could have a hypothalamic problem or overactivation that leads to the proliferation of those cells producing more ACTH, driving cortisol levels upwards. So that's one possibility, is that you have a neuroendocrine tumor elsewhere. The other possibility is that you might actually have a disorder known as glucocorticoid resistance. And this is where the patients who have this disorder have an inherited problem with the glucocorticoid receptor where it doesn't work as well. So in order to have a normal glucocorticoid effect, their pituitary adrenal axis gets ratcheted upwards, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, I should say, gets ratcheted upwards to make enough cortisol so that they're normal. So they don't look Cushing weight at all, but they can have very elevated cortisol levels. And they suppress somewhat with dexamethasone, but the key thing is that they have a normal diurnal variation of cortisol. So if you checked salivary cortisols in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, you'd find out that they have a normal diurnal variation. And those patients would have ACTH hyperplasia as well, because their pituitary is having to work harder to drive the adrenals to make more cortisol to satisfy the cortisol receptor that are in the body tissues. So it's a very interesting situation. I don't know which of the two you would have. You'd have to go back and see whether you actually had Cushing syndrome with your cortisol levels that you reported it being 12 times normal. Discuss that with your physician and see what they think about that hypothesis.
Okay, great. Here's the next question we selected. Have you treated patients for congenital genetic growth hormone deficiency? Would you recommend staying on growth hormone treatment while pregnant?
I have treated several patients who I thought probably had congenital growth hormone deficiency due to one reason or another. We didn't test whether it was genetic or related to birth injury. And patients who have this disorder usually require growth hormone replacement for life. However, during pregnancy, the placenta makes two hormones. One is human chorionic somatomammotropin, the other is human placental lactogen, and both of those have growth hormone-like effects. So usually we stop growth hormone during pregnancy because you really don't need it. IGF-1 levels are maintained by these other hormones. And in fact, if you look at normal pregnant women, many of them are said to look acromegaloid during pregnancy, and it's because of these hormones raising IGF-1 levels and having direct effects on body tissues, causing those changes in a normal pregnant woman. So it's not necessary to take growth hormone during a pregnancy. In fact, I had one patient who had hypopituitarism and who had not been treated with growth hormone, who was overweight. Every time she got pregnant, she lost weight, 30 or 40 pounds, and felt better, felt great during her pregnancies. After delivery, would gain weight, feel puny, would get pregnant again. I think she had two or three pregnancies like this, and would get pregnant again, would lose weight, would feel better. And it was due to the growth hormone effect of these hormones that was basically treating her growth hormone deficiency. So when we finally diagnosed her, which came in for referral, we diagnosed her, started on growth hormone, she lost weight, felt great just as if she were pregnant, but of course she wasn't. She was just simply on growth hormone. So I hope that answers your question. It's very interesting, and good luck with continued treatment with your growth hormone.
Okay, these are all great questions. So here's another one. Should a person with newly diagnosed acromegaly have a baseline echocardiogram done even though one has no apparent heart-related symptoms, or any other baseline tests of those disorders often related to acromegaly?
That's a very good question. Some patients with acromegaly do have underlying cardiac dysfunction, usually stiffening of the heart or enlargement of the heart. Sometimes when the heart gets enlarged, people have valvular heart disease as a result. Typically, I don't do echocardiograms on patients, even if there are no apparent heart-related symptoms. But the right questions have to be asked. Does someone have shortness of breath when laying down or on exercise, for example? Do they have hypertension? Does the physician hear an S4 gallop on examination? Those are the things that might prompt an echocardiogram. If you look at echocardiograms in normal people, roughly about 8% of normal people have an abnormal echocardiogram. So it doesn't mean that an abnormal echocardiogram is definitely related to acromegaly because of that. So my usual approach is if a patient has symptoms and has hypertension, probably it's worthwhile to get an echocardiogram. But I'll tell you that severe cardiac dysfunction is rare in acromegaly. It used to be very common, but we don't see it too much anymore. I've probably seen three good cases of, I don't mean good, but three classic cases of cardiac dysfunction or cardiac failure in acromegalic patients in the past 25 years. So it's an unusual situation, but to improve your health, if you're interested, if you have hypertension or an S4 gallop, or a shortness of breath on exertion, you probably should discuss with your physician about whether or not to have an echocardiogram. I will say that if you are considering medical therapy with dopamine agonist drugs and you have acromegaly, it's probably a good idea to get that baseline echocardiogram in that setting because of the questionable effect that dopamine agonist drugs can have on causing valvular heart disease and the fact that some patients with acromegaly do have a cardiomyopathy to begin with. Well, I want to thank you all for the questions. I didn't have time to get to everything. We still have some great questions, and we'll try to get to those in a second podcast at a future time. Once again, thanks for your interest in Pituitary World News. We hope that you find this and every podcast useful and interesting. And keep the questions coming, because these are some of our favorite type of podcasts to do, and we've been happy to address your questions in the future. Have a wonderful day. This has been Dr. Lewis Blevins podcasting from the coast of Northern California. Take care.
You've been listening to another exclusive presentation of our podcast series, Ask Dr. Blevins, by Pituitary World News. Thank you for listening.